Thanks, Olivia, for the introduction, and thanks, organizers, for having me at this very cool conference. Yeah, I'd like to tell you a bit about Hamiltonian learning for quantum error correction today. It's a project I have with our super talented grad student, Agnes Valente, Evert van Nieuwenburg, who you heard from in the morning, and Sebastian Huber. So the central question I want to ask and answer in this talk is whether Hamiltonian learning can provide new ideas and angles for quantum error correction. So this can sound like a very like specific technical question. So let me break it down into the three messages I would like to deliver to you today. So first one is that quantum error correction is important, and it's a well-studied field within like quantum information theory. And basically the main idea is that if we want to use our quantum processors and simulators the way we are thinking about it today, we need some algorithmic solution to correct for the errors that these devices pick up during whatever we are doing with them. Second message is that Hamiltonian learning is important. So that's just something when you want to use your quantum system to do something that you want, you have access to the measurements on these systems. And then from these measurements, you want to verify that the Hamiltonian or the interaction or more other general dynamics you are engineering is the one you wanted. And that's what Hamiltonian learning is all about. And then in this talk, I would like to bring them together and show that this combination can bring some useful insights. So let's start from a very basic consideration. As a physicist, we often approach problems in this kind of toy model approach, that we write a Hamiltonian and then we try to find the eigenstates and learn from them something about the dynamics of the system. So we learned yesterday from Giuseppe that it can be like super hard to do this in practice, but at least in theory we would know how to do it, and we have a well-established and various set of tools to approach this problem. But then we also heard the talk of Emily, who has access to only some measurements on her state in her lab. And then that kind of defines this inverse problem, that you have access to some measurements and you would like to reconstruct your Hamiltonian from them. And that's a question that is much harder and in general, like not unique at all, how to do this reconstruction. But it's something that it's really in core of what a lot of experimental groups are doing, right? They engineer some Hamiltonian, some interaction that is interesting, and then they go in and measure things, and with the hope that these measurement outcomes corresponds exactly to what you are engineering and it confirms some hypothesis or theory that you are testing. So There is a really big family of these problems that exists within this Hamiltonian learning. So I don't want to address them in general, but I will look at the relevant example that is really important for this future of quantum information processing, at least how we think about it today, and that's quantum error correction. So I see a lot of experts in the audience, but I will use a couple of slides just to give you a quick reminder of what's the motivation for doing quantum error correction and how it works. So you will create some type of quantum device, some qubit, and then you will want it to do things. But then some noise may come, and then I show here like one example of what could happen is that the spin will flip the sign. And now imagine that you have a bunch of them, and if this happens all the time, how do you know that at the end of your calculation you are getting anything that has something to do with what you wanted to get? So then you tell me, okay, so the solution for this is really simple. I get inspired by the classical computers and I do something like this, some type of majority vote. So that would be like a first step and first intuition to approach this problem. Thing is that this quantum noise is not just this binary bit flip, but it can be much more complicated. So this encoding of the quantum state has to be bit more elaborate. And what is like a flagship idea for this quantum error correction, at least for a really fault tolerant quantum error correction, is a Kitaev's idea from 2003, when you use the ground state of some cleverly chosen Hamiltonian to encode your logical qubit. So instead of saying these three things are one qubit that will decide my thing, this ground state or something within this ground state will decide the state. So this story code Hamiltonian, it's a sum of two four-body interactions. You have a product of four sigma axis on this, we call it a star operator, and product of four sigma z's. That's the so-called Plaquette operator. The beautiful thing about this model is that these two objects, they commute with each other, and the ground state manifold of this model is well known, and you can really write the ground state analytically. Now, the ground state manifold of this model is degenerate. And how? It depends on what topology you put it on. So if I were to introduce a periodic boundary conditions in both 2D directions of this lattice and put it on the torus, then I would get a degeneracy 4. And roughly speaking, how the protection of the states in this model then works is that I would have to go along this red line and flip every single of these spins to get into another ground state, or along this blue line. So this sort of gives you two cuts or two non-contractible loops that allows you switch between these four ground states. But at the same time, it's not really easy to switch, especially if this lattice is big. So the idea is that it's not something that really happens by accident. Now, there are two approaches to study this model. There is like a quantum information and like how people traditionally think about quantum error correction ones, that you study measurements you can do on an arbitrary ground state and then translate these measurements into the corrective operations to get the state that you want. I will explain this a little bit more in a second. Another way to think about this is to study this family of the topological Hamiltonians, figure out when the ground states are degenerate, when the models are analytically solvable, and so on. And these are like two main approaches that I would like to combine and hopefully get something interesting out of it. So, without one way to arrive into this topologically degenerate ground state is just take an arbitrary quantum state and start measuring these star and Plaquette operators I told you about. And you measure them really, really frequently. And you keep projecting on the eigenspaces. And you want to project on the correct eigenspace on all these operators so you would find yourself in a ground state. That doesn't happen all the time, so there are the so-called decoders. Those are algorithmic tools that allows you to translate your wrong measurement result into a one-spin fixes that you then do on your lattice. And then you just repeat this over and over, and if everything went well, you will find yourself in the ground state. Then another way to think about how to arrive to this ground state is that, okay, what if I would engineer this four-body interaction directly? This is admittedly a hard thing, but there is some experimental progress in that direction already and some interesting theoretical proposals out there. Let's say that I just go and engineer the Hamiltonian the best I can. Then I will be in some ground state of the interaction. And then this Hamiltonian learning angle comes in. I engineer the best I can. I have some ground state of that Hamiltonian. And then I go in and do the measurements. And I hope that I picked my measurements smartly. And I learn the Hamiltonian from that measurements. That allows me to identify some systematic errors and imprecisions that I made when I was engineering my Hamiltonian, correct them, and hopefully I arrive to the topological ground state that I was interested in. So those are like two separate things. Either I can start from the arbitrary state and just keep projecting and really project myself all the way to the ground state, or I can just engineer what I want and be in the ground state by construction. So Let's go back to this story code model. As I was saying, it's analytically solvable, and some smart people a few years ago, Claudio Chamon and Claudio Castelnuovo, asked themselves, how can you modify this model to keep it still analytically solvable and topologically degenerate and keep all these beautiful properties? And what they found out is they can add term that looks like this. It might look a little bit peculiar, but if you would expand this into the lowest order, you would basically get that you get sigma z field with the amplitude beta on some of the spins. So it's basically an elaborate way to add some background field. And from now on, I will always denote this sigma z background field in a blue color. Point is that if you add the background field to your topological Hamiltonian like this, it stays solvable. The ground states remain degenerate. And you can still write it in, you can write it in terms of your original Torricode Hamiltonian with some prefactor. What does this mean? That if your engineering went slightly off what you wanted, it may be that you still get a topological degenerate ground state and everything is good, except that the state is it's not exactly what you wanted, but something slightly different. So then you can play the following game. You can figure out on which spins and in which directions you put this background field, and you can find the phase diagram of this model. I don't have time to explain this in detail in this talk, but you can find it in our paper. But basically you can find out which are the different ways to put the fields that gets you out of the topological phase and which never gets you out of the topological phase. Now, when you understand these topological diagrams and these added fields and analytical solvability, you can repeat the same game for exactly like similar but slightly different perturbation. For example, adding some background sigma x field to the Plaquet term. And then everything I just said symmetrically apply. You again don't have to, you this added field don't have to break the topological degeneracy. You can find the phase diagram and so on. Now, what we found out is that with these types of Hamiltonians, all we need to identify the field on a given spin, either this background sigma z field or sigma x field, is just to have these three expectation values that are expectation values of the neighboring either star or Plaquet operator. So all you need basically is a correlation function of the neighboring star or a Plaquet operator. And this is enough to map this. And you can map this expectation value on a background field on that spin. And actually, the function was pretty hard to find, so we chose to approximate it by a neural network. So up until this point, everything I said was relying on this analytically solvable state. This Hamiltonian, if I put the fields in a certain way, there are some restrictions that apply, let's for the sake of the talk here, the states that I will call analytically solvable, those are the ones who have the blue field and red field on a separate spins. And if I put both on the same spin, I would have a problem. So just pictorially, when it looks like this, it's analytically solvable. What I can then do is to evaluate these three expectation values. I just choose spin, evaluate this expectation value, and train this network that looks like this, just three-layer dense network, to return me the background field on that particular spin. So then I just can create by the training set by changing the spin distribution in the rest of the lattice. So then I train this model on this analytically solvable topological states that I knew the properties of and could write the analytical expression for. Now, the question is whether I can apply to the states that do not fulfill this restriction. And we found out that indeed you can. So I will pictorially show you here in the lattice some distribution of the fields that belong to the Hamiltonian that is not analytically solvable. So now you can see that the lattice got significantly smaller because now you really have to treat it. I have to do full quantum state to really write this state and calculate the eigenvalues. So I do that. I take this model that was pre-trained on this analytical solvable state. I feed it the three expectation values for each spin. I identify the fields that are there, and I just tell the algorithm, okay, remove it now. How this would be done in practice, that depends on a particular implementation. You could do adiabatic transition from one Hamiltonian to another, or just do some gates. In our thing is just a simulation, so we just really subtract the field. So you see that I do one step of this, and it improved. But yeah, for this spin, for example, it didn't really go well. So what I do is that I apply this network over and over and over until I converge to something that is almost perfect toric code state where I remove the field. So this would be, in this example of this particular state, this would be how it looks like after 5 iterations of the protocol. There is a slight complication that it's not as linear as I'm showing here, because sometimes the network could be stuck in the loop or something like that, so there is some additional decision tree structure. But basically, how it works is really just this iterative structure. So up to this point, I was basically just showing you like a colorful blobs and tell you to trust me that I am removing some background fields even from the states I couldn't classically simulate. So let me introduce two measures that we chose to characterize what was the precision of what we are doing. And one is on the level of the state that we are correcting, and that will be something that is related to this traditional quantum error correction technique. And other will be on the level of the Hamiltonian. It will be the question of how well are we learning this topological Hamiltonian. So on the level of the state, what we do is following. Up until this point, I kept insistently repeating that if you choose this Hamiltonian engineering approach, you never measure anything. You just engineer the Hamiltonian, and then you are in the ground state because you have to be in the ground state because that's the most energetically beneficial state to be in. But if I want to compare to this projection method, what I do is that I ask myself, if I project it on a given state, on this stabilizer subspaces, what would be a probability that a spin flip would result out of that? These spin flips, single spin probabilities, they are important indication how these decoding algorithms can work. So you see that if I would start from this slightly misengineered Hamiltonian, I would have a spin flip probability like 12, 13, 14%. So, and that happens to be a probability for which many decoders would fail. But if I would do this iterative procedure to really fine-tune the Hamiltonian perfectly and arrive to the ground state best I can via Hamiltonian engineering, I would have a single spin flip probability at the level of 0.01%, which would result in a really low probability of decoding the state wrong if you would want to continue your calculation with this state. And then the second measure, it's on a Hamiltonian level. And it's really just about express the Hamiltonian in some basis that is independent from the parameters that you are estimating, and then calculate the L2 distance between the expansion coefficient. So this is the measure that was introduced in this paper of Netanel Lindner group. So in our case, it gets a little bit annoying, so I will not go through it, but this is really the idea. You just expand the Hamiltonian and then you find the distance of the expansion coefficients and it tells you how well you are doing. So now pictorially, I will show here on this left log axis the probability that a single qubit will flip face or spin. And on this axis, also a log axis, I show a Hamiltonian error. This is the iteration of the protocol, and I always show you this field distribution that comes with it. So you see that I go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I am exactly at this level of hundreds of percent of the spin flip error and really low distance between this expansion coefficients in the Hamiltonian that I found. So another question is, how this type of algorithm scale with a system size? So luckily we found out that it doesn't, even though from some point we only could simulate the analytical states and not a full quantum one. This would be the system size L, and you have 2 L squared spins in that lattice, so it actually start growing pretty quickly. But our estimation of those errors state approximately the same throughout the process. And final quick comment before I finish is that we also studied how measurement noise affects these things. I keep telling you that you may have an error in your Hamiltonian engineering and then I tell you how to fix it. But up until this point, I assume that the expectation values I feed into the train network are actually exact, which is not fair, right? Because even when measuring these expectation values, you will always have some measurement error. So we make this plot of how these two errors I introduce scale with the standard deviation of Gaussian noise on top of these expectation values. And for realistic signal-to-noise ratios, you actually stay comfortably without 3%, below 3% error, which is something this standard decoders and standard quantum information theory can deal with very well. So, just to make a conclusion of what I was trying to show you today, is that we can learn a topological code Hamiltonian by measuring a linear number of expectation values. This is something that would in principle allow you to identify the systematic errors in the Hamiltonian learning. So you have access to this state, and basically what we did is that we found out the minimal set of measurements you need to do that happens to be linear in your number of qubits to find the sufficient information to really characterize the Hamiltonian in case of these topological quantum codes. So with this work, we are trying to make an argument that there can be another approach to error correction that is done more on the Hamiltonian level, that you engineer what you want and then you correct it. And then it could be something that complements this standard projection and decoding technique. And it could be something that helps you calibrate your interaction such that you don't start from a slightly wrong state even before you do anything else, because as I was showing with this single spin errors, even if you do a small error at the beginning in your Hamiltonian, suddenly the rest of your algorithms could go really wrong. So this is kind of like a Hamiltonian learning calibration technique that we apply in this case to to quantum error correction. So let me thank again to my collaborators. The paper is on archive, and we created like a minimal code package that is available on Git, where everyone can try to correct their own topological state. Thank you.
So I'm just curious, how does like correcting the Hamiltonian relate to controlling, designing your controls versus correcting your Hamiltonian, like designing a Hamiltonian? How do these two relate? Are they the same or?
So just to make sure I understand the question. So you say, what is the difference between Hamiltonian learning and quantum control?
Yeah.
I know very little. I know very little about quantum control. Yeah, but I see what you are saying, that we kind of, so in this particular case, yeah, I guess we turn it a bit into the quantum control thing by incorporating it into this algorithm that is really correcting the states and arriving to. That's actually a great point. But I think in general, it's not true. I think in general, this like Hamiltonian learning buzzword really just refers to what is the mapping from the measurements you can do on the Hamiltonian just to learn it. And then the quantum control is taking the extra step and incorporating it into some bigger algorithm, but that's a very interesting point. Maybe you have some more insights we can talk about that.
Thank you.
So you started by introducing the Torah code, mm-hmm. And you had the two loops representing the four qubits on the torus for the. The question is, in practice, people talk more about surface codes, and it wasn't clear to me from your presentation how much of the, it didn't seem to be, but I'm just wondering how much of this is dependent on the periodic boundary condition.
Oh, it's not at all, and maybe I chose toric code because I do condensed matter now more than quantum information, so it's like a flagship first example to do, but everything I did could be with just two qubits encoded in the ground state and having like a generic stabilizer code. And in fact, you have a great point because it's the stabilizer codes that people think about in practice, right? Because this periodic boundary conditions, they are really hard to implement. So doing it in one dimension is enough. So this was really just what I saw as a pedagogical choice, but everything goes for stabilizer as well.
Thank you.
One more question? If not, we'll thank Eliska again.
Okay, so today I'll take some of your time to talk about the quantum approximate optimization algorithm, and I'll briefly describe it, and then I'll tell you something about our results for spin chains. So this is work that I've done in CISA in collaboration with Rosario Fazio from ICTP and Giuseppe Santoro from this. Let me start first talking about how, why, about the problem you want to tackle with this algorithm. So the problem is classical optimization. So you have a classical cost function which you want to optimize, and this is defined over a discrete set of variables. So when you have such a, so an example of such a problem can be the max cut problem, where you have a graph and you want to find the bipartition such that the number of edges you cut to obtain this bipartition is maximized. So you can formulate this as a problem of minimizing this cost function, which depends on binary variables. This Si and Sj assume value plus one and minus one. So you can see them as classical spin. So also problems such as this one are interesting because they are, from a classical point of view, they are hard, and it's also hard just to find an approximate solution. And so you can define, like here, a residual energy. So let's say given a solution, what the discrepancy between your solution and the exact solution. And this, it's hard also to get values below, a large residual energy. So the question is whether using quantum devices is possible to do better than this. And this is a good setting because already the classical algorithm is not working well. So one possible solution, which has been it's been popular for a long time, is the analog quantum annealing algorithm. So simply you promote your classical degrees of freedom to quantum degrees of freedom, and then you then have an Hamiltonian which lives in an Hilbert space. Now, the ground state of this Hamiltonian is the solution of your problem. And how can you find this? You can find it by doing what is called quantum annealing. You consider an extra term, which is usually taken to be a transverse field Hamiltonian, and you combine the two Hamiltonians in a single one. Okay? And then you slowly interpolate between the simple Hamiltonian, driving Hamiltonian, and the problem Hamiltonian, okay? So if the interpolation you do is slow enough during the time evolution, the Diabaki theorem will assure that if you start from the ground state of the simple Hamiltonian, you'll end up in the ground state of your final Hamiltonian, which is the problem Hamiltonian. So this technically solves your classical optimization problem. So what happens is that it relies on this adiabatic theorem that requires that you should have you shouldn't have small gaps appearing during the evolution. So the time you'll need to perform this simulation on your device will scale roughly as 1 over the smallest gap you encounter squared. Okay? And in this paradigm, so in this framework, hard problems will emerge when you have a small vanishing gap. Already you find a problem is that for a hard problem, you'll need a long time to perform the simulation. And this is a problem because of coherence in your device. If you optimize the schedule, you can also do it better as 1 over the gap as well. It's here there are, I've put all constants to 1. Here there should be like a constant depending on the Hamiltonian. So if you see like here, as you see this, there should be something which depends on absolute value of the Hamiltonian anyway, something. Here I've put everything to 1, so that's why you do not see it. So it's 1 over gap squared, but you do not see it, of course. Okay, so let me start by saying that what I described before was meant to run on an analog device. You can also use first order truth theorization to obtain a digital simulation. And now you'll be simply applying alternatively the two Hamiltonians, so HX and HZ, the problem and the driving, and this will give you a unitary circuit, okay? So you start from the initial state, which is the ground state of HX, and then you apply the Hamiltonian. So if you do this and you are using a sufficiently good discretization, you should still be able to get the ground state of the Hamiltonian, so the algorithm should still work well on a digital device. So the problem when you do this is that you may get a very deep circuit, which is hard to simulate, okay? So you have to transfer your problem in the one of from long times to deep circuits. And what happens is that a further step will tell you that since you're using this to parameterize, so this is your what you want to be close to the finals, to the ground state of your system, you may even just consider these duration times for which you're applying the Hamiltonians as variational parameters and optimize over them. So now you have a circuit that is producing a variational state, and it's done by your device. And what you do is you optimize over this variational state. So you can perform a classical optimization algorithm, and this will give you out some optimal values for the duration, and you can use this to obtain your state. So by measurements, you can then get a classical state which is close enough to the grounds that you're looking for. So if you optimize, of course, if you start from a digital solution, you can do a little better. So we know that you'll do better than the simple digital annealing, which is the correspond to the analog annealing. So the reason why this algorithm, which was proposed in 2014 by Fari, has become so popular is because actually, it's been shown that already for low depth circuits, so P equal one, so it can be competitive with classical algorithms, okay? So actually for some time, it was also better than a classical algorithm, okay? And the other reason is that it's possible to realize it in experiments, so this is, here I show you some, just to tell you that here's the group of Martinis, Google, here's the group of Zoller in Innsbruck, and what they do is, here they perform the digital simulation that I described in an experimental setup with superconducting qubits, and here with trapped ions, they perform an additional optimization over a variational state they obtain with the device. And actually it works. But these are still experiments which are not yet competitive with classical algorithms. So here, what I will discuss will be mainly the problem in a simple setting, that of the easing chain, so which you can see as one of those an instance of the max cut problem I described before. And simply you have an easing chain, antiferromagnetic, with periodic boundary condition, okay? And what you want to do is prepare the ground state of this system. So this is useful to compare with experimental results. So you will get something that can be compared with experimental results. And moreover, it's interesting because the system undergoes a phase transition when you tune this parameter S of interpolation. So the gap closes here, and from the point of view of quantum annealing, this is it becomes difficult to solve, okay? So let me give you a preview of what I'll be doing in the first part. I'll be describing some variational bound you can obtain for the residual energy in this kind of problems. So I will show that when the depth of the circuit twice the temporal circuit is smaller than the size of the system, you must have some defects, and this will be quantified by 1/2 p+2. And of course, and when in the other case, when the circuit is deep enough, you actually do not have this bound and can obtain zero residual energy. So I'll show this actually. So this I'll show it to you from a theoretical point of view, and then I'll show your numerical results that actually confirm this and also extend it. So somehow. So let me start by telling you some of the things to use for the variational bound. So I start by using the fact that the system is translationally invariant. So I can, instead of computing the energy on the whole Hamiltonian, I can focus only on two sides. So, and then the next thing is that I'll start by using this picture where I consider a discrete time evolution, and the time here is given by the depth of the circuit. So I apply two of these gates, and I say that my time has increased by one. Okay, and the final state is the state obtained at time p. So then I can consider a Heisenberg representation for my problem. Okay, so I use the Heisenberg picture, and I prefer to check to study the evolution of this operator, which is exactly what appears in the residual energy. So if you do this, you will actually immediately see that that you do not need to know to retain the whole system to perform the computation. So let me give you an example. So this is the Heisenberg picture, and at the first step, I have to apply this operator, this discrete time evolution operator, left and right. And what happens is that since most of the terms in the operators HX and HZ commute with what is at the center, I will remain only with the terms that do not commute with what I have at the center, okay? And then this means that at this level, I can perform my computation using a reduced chain. So in the picture you see here, I'm talking about this case, and I can perform my computation on a reduced chain with only four spin. Okay, if the depth of the circuit is if the circuit is deeper, then I will need to consider a larger reduced chain, and in general the size of the reduced chain will be 2p+2, where p is the depth of the circuit. So it's important here to notice that in this reduced chain there is no term, boundary term, which is linking this pin here and this pin here. So although I had the periodic boundary condition, as long as we did this light cone has not reached the boundary of the system, the two spins at the end do not talk to each other, and the boundary term is absent. In particular, you can show that when performing computation on this reduced chain, it doesn't matter the kind of boundary condition you put on the chain. And it's particularly convenient, so I will discuss better about it later, to consider a periodic boundary condition. So this means simply that I take a frustrating bound here, which is where I change its time, okay? And then I can work now on a reduced chain, so I have all these HZ, HX, and which are all defined on this chain now, which has size 2p+2, and I can also, the final state will also be defined on this chain, okay? So again, the quantity I said that to compute before was this one, due to translational invariance. But now, if I use antiperiodic boundary conditions, somehow I still have translational invariance, okay? So you can show that translational invariance is maintained as long as the initial state is actually this phi0, which is the ground state of HX, and that's the case. And so instead of computing this, you can directly put the Hamiltonian, the density of the Hamiltonian, okay? And what happens is that now you have a residual energy, and here you have an Hamiltonian, and it's the expectation value of the Hamiltonian over a state, essentially. And this is the frustrated Hamiltonian, okay? But what happens is that the frustrated Hamiltonian now cannot satisfy all bounds as before, because it's not possible to have a state where all these terms are set to minus one. So the ground state energy has an offset. This is this two due to this frustrating bound. And the result is that if you use the simple variational principle, you immediately get the bound I described before, okay? So this tells us immediately that the residual energy, so the how well I can approximate the state, the final state with depth p, it's bounded, and I need a deeper circuit to get a good residual energy. Okay, so this is interesting, and what you find actually by numerical simulation is that if you consider a system of length n, the bound is actually tight, so it's not just greater or equal. I'm actually able to go right to the bound and satisfy it exactly, okay? And actually where the bound is no more holding, so where we just have a trivial bound where this quantity is positive, so as I define it to be always positive, this is a trivial bound. And I get that again, I always satisfy the trivial bound. So the bound I gave gives the complete picture of the algorithm in this setting and captures all its limitations. So an extension of what I just discussed is actually this paper that suggests that you can use the algorithm also for state ground state preparation, and it's quite quite useful, because instead of considering the target Hamiltonian, so the Hamiltonian of which you have to get the ground state to be only this, as we were doing before, you consider the full Hamiltonian and apply the same algorithm. Again, due to the adiabatic theorem, you know that this is a good algorithm, and as long as you have a very, 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 very deep circuit, you will converge. But then you do not. Know how deep you need the circuit to be. Okay, so you do the same thing as before. You use the variational state, and then you optimize over the variational state. Again, the arguments I described before, I will not show it here because it's a simple generalization, can be generalized to the case of arbitrary target H, okay? And again, here you see these are the exact result for the bound, which will correspond to this line here in the case of H equals zero, and I also have here. And again, the bound we show here, it's tight. So it's possible to get right up to the bound, and the bound completely captures again all the limitation also of the algorithm when used as an algorithm to prepare the ground state of the transfer easing model. Okay. So this will close the first part, where we study the limitations of the algorithm and its performance in this system. And then what we wanted to do next was consider the kind of solutions you get when you apply this kind of algorithm. So if you do a random search starting from a random initial point, you get just a messy solution. So here I'm plotting a parameter S of M, which is related to the durations just by inverting the trotterization I used before. So actually this is just, you start by doing it just as a simple transformation. It actually may not have any meaning, But you can see that you can actually just by imposing using an iterative construction, which is here as here starts from the equal to case from a practically linear solution, then you use the you optimize, and here you do not actually get nothing different. In the next case, for p equal 4, you start from this optimal solution. You go to p equal 2, and you and you optimize again. And you can perform this iteratively, and what you get is that at the end of the story, you get a schedule that becomes flatter and flatter, close to the phase transition. So we didn't tell the algorithm while we're optimizing anything about the presence of a phase transition. We just use iterative optimization and iterative initialization, but it's able to find that the phase transition is its position and slow down when it's needed to perform an almost adiabatic solution to an adiabatic schedule. Okay, so what is relevant is that no spectral information is needed. And if you see the dynamics as you put together these two blocks, as is natural when you invert the trotterization, you can show by considering this entropy that will simply tell you how much adiabatic is the evolution. You can show that this solution we find is actually more adiabatic than the usual linear solution. So not only it finds an optimal solution, but this structure gives you an optimal solution, which is also adiabatic, as you'll get in the usual adiabatic setting. So you can compare the solution you get to other usual approaches when you want to find optimal adiabatic solutions in protocols for a system, and usually for state preparation. And usually what happens is that to get a good algorithm, you need to know some spectral information. So here is the simple linear schedule, which gives results 1 over square root of the time, and due to Keeble-Zurek mechanism. And here are some schedule proposed by Roland Cerf and Paul Kovnikov that you see here, which are supposed to be better than and are better than the linear one. But the one we find here, it's actually again has a better scaling than the one proposed, and again it doesn't use spectral information to be computed. So let me just conclude saying, what are the open issues? So we are trying to see how special is the case we have considered. Actually, we know that the bound we gave can be easily generalized to higher dimension and to non-integrable models, but we do not know if it's tight. So we should verify if the bound still in this case is able to capture the whole limitations of the algorithm. And the role of noise and disorder in the system, this we have not studied, so we just assume that you were getting perfect measurements. And we use explicitly locality of the Hamiltonians we are considering. So this is related to Lib-Robinson bound, and it'll be interesting to see if something similar can be done in fully connected models where this locality is lost. Okay, so I'll conclude saying that we just showed how to obtain variational bounds for this way algorithm, which also hold in case of arbitrary ground state preparation for the easing mode and transverse field. In that case, the bounds are also tight, and you can use the algorithm in find and construct optimal annealing schedule, which learn by themselves the spectral information they need to gain a speed up to slow down when the gap is closing. So, okay, so this is all, and I'd like to thank you for your attention.
Symmetry broken phase, like from the ground state of sigma x to ground state of sigma z, right? That was the goal.
Yes, not necessarily here. Actually, I'm considering also different values of h, so also in same phase.
Yeah, but let's say if you are interested in going from the one phase to the other phase, isn't it true that if I allow in QAOA a term which is proportional to sigma z itself?
So let me say that if I go back here, here, okay? Here I'm using the fact that I'm recovering translational invariance somehow. And as I said, you need special condition on the initial Hamiltonian, on the initial state, also on the Hamiltonian. The condition on the Hamiltonian is that it's symmetric for a spin flip.
That's fine. I'm asking a very different question.
Okay.
Let me finish my
question. Oh, sorry. I thought you just finished.
I'm saying that you should be able to go from the ordered, from the ground state, which is of the sigma z Hamiltonian,
yeah,
to the ground state of sigma x Hamiltonian,
yeah,
within order one unitary. If your unitaries break the symmetry, the Ising symmetry, then there's a very short circuit going from one to another because they belong to the same phase of matter if you break the Ising symmetry.
Yes.
So isn't that a much faster, then you don't need a very deep circuit. Your circuit here seems to be very deep because your unitaries are preserving the symmetry of the Ising Hamiltonian, which is sigma z to minus sigma z symmetry.
Yes.
If I break that symmetry, that unitary circuit.
No, you're right. So let me say, we have in mind when we talk about this generalization, we have in mind to study what happens when you are having a system where there are gaps. So here the gaps which are closing. Here in this one, there is only one gap which is closing and it's easy to avoid and you can avoid it, as you're saying.
In usual condition,
you will have, if you have a difficult problem, you have many gaps which are closing
sure.
and it's not easy to avoid it. What we are trying to study here is the crossing of the gap. So we do not have the power to tackle directly the complicated problem. So we tackle this problem and we make it so that it's not possible to do this thing that you just described.
There's no glassy features. So.
Yes, exactly. So to the difficulty arises because we do not allow that term. Otherwise, you'll have...
Sure, I understand.
Sure.
Okay, maybe related to this, probably I didn't get, but am I wrong or you always need a minimum number of gates which is extensive in the number of sides?
Yes, you're right.
So how can you do that with one gate?
Only if he doesn't break the symmetry.
Yes.
If you don't break the Ising symmetry, then the two ground states are different phases of matter. So there has to be that. It has to be a new circuit. But if you're also getting more general, then.
Yes, but just one thing. Also here, it scales exponentially. You didn't mention it. But also here, there is a bound when you have the system in same phase of matter. Okay, so it's yeah, if definitely this bound here goes to zero exponentially, but still you cannot achieve with unitary fidelity. Also, if you are without extensive gates, also if you are in same phase of matter,
right.
So you still need same phase of matter. You still need an extensive number.
So that's a leak to the Lib-Robinson if you want this exponential thing that this thing that is not exactly zero, right?
Yes. Yeah. So to do is the Lightcon approach is due to the to the Lib-Robinson. Yes, what would be surprising to me is that this approach completely captures and you can actually, it gives you exactly the value, the best value you can obtain in this system. So just to conclude, I was saying, so here actually it will be interesting to see, because we use it both here and here where the phases are the same. So somehow we are not using the fact that we are changing phase to get the bounds. That's.
Since you also mentioned in the Futures perspective about the fully connected spin system, can you comment? So your results, they are related to the spectrum of excitation of the model. But in the, so because you have this exponent, that's the Kibble-Zurek, and so what happens when you have a spectrum of excitation that is discrete, like in the fully connected model where you won't have a dispersion for your excitation?
So actually, we started looking at the fully connected model. And so first of all, nothing of what I've discussed would really apply, because you do not have the picture I discussed before. So what we see in the fully connected model, actually, is we started looking at p equal 2 p spin and p equal 3. So for 3, you also have an exponentially closing gap. And so you know that actually, since you have violating this, you can solve with a reasonable small circuit, you can get a good result. And in that case, you can find it. There are a circuit of depth 2 that solves your problem, for at least for when you have this, when you do not have this term. Otherwise, actually, you still need to go to a deeper circuit. But what is interesting that we find in this case is that as I said, there is involved here a local optimization is involved in this thing. So you must know how this local optimization is performing. So we find that still in these models, there is the local optimization doesn't perform well till you arrive at a size of p, a depth p of n. And then it drops to 0 also for the local optimization. So for a certain depth of the circuit that scales with n, the local optimization is able to find with arbitrary precision the final, to get you to the final ground state. So that's in that case, that's what I can say that happens. So interesting, because usually you'll use only a local optimization. Then it's actually not enough, because we are considering mean field models to do this. And I do not know if it probably what stays and what doesn't stay when you consider a non-integrable model.